Hello and welcome to EpiCast, a podcast series about epidemics from Sonar Global, a social science network funded by the European Commission. The aim of these podcasts is to explore the social dimensions of infectious disease outbreaks so that we can get better at controlling them. For this episode, we're discussing data, COVID-19 data to be precise. I'm Annie Wilkinson, a researcher at the Institute of Development Studies in the UK, and I'm joined by four guests who have been thinking about the social aspects and implications of data. The COVID-19 pandemic has been unprecedented for the amount of data which is produced daily about the disease. The public and scientists are inundated with case counts, dashboards, maps, league tables, and models. Controversies over evidence, death rates, side effects, and predictions have been a defining feature, as has a concern with misinformation. And in this episode, we wanted to question how data is being created, used, and interpreted. First, I'll be speaking with Mark Davies about epidemic narratives and the prominence of data in them. Then I'll be talking with Joel Solinicchio about data visualization and some of the problems with common ways of representing the COVID-19 pandemic. And finally, with Tamara Giles-Vernick and Leonard Heyerdahl about the COVID-19 infodemic, what it is and why we need to understand it better. And finally, of course, all of these conversations have happened over Zoom, so please excuse some of the poor sound quality. First up is my conversation with Mark Davies about epidemic narratives.
So I'm in the School of Social Sciences at Monash University. So I'm a social scientist, interested in qualitative methods and theories of the subject and society and how that might inform public health strategies. So I'm interested in communications and news media and narratives and the storytelling that people use to make sense of their lives. And I've worked on pandemic influenza, and I'm currently working on antimicrobial resistance.
So could you give me a brief introduction into epidemic narratives, what they are, maybe how they've been used in the past in previous epidemics?
Yeah, I think that a little bit of medical history, a little bit of literary history really, reveals how often we tell stories about pandemics. You know, the three-act play before the kind of event and then afterwards, that's the shape of a pandemic. If you start to really look at how narratives play here, you'll start to see that they're there. And then when you look at public health materials, health education, the story-like qualities that start to bubble up in how we communicate about risks like these.
Would you say there's often something kind of sensationalist about these stories? So as well as the pandemics having a structure, a beginning, middle and end, is there a particular kind of narrative arc or particular quality sometimes to the stories about pandemics?
Yes, but there have been shifts and changes. So journalists have become much more reflexive with how they write these stories. So when we looked at swine flu, so this is 2009, 2010, a lot of the people we spoke with said the media had hyped the pandemic. But then we looked at the texts, there wasn't any hyping. It was all very fact-based. So there's something about the medium is the message. Like, I think what publics noticed is just how much media there was. So publics, looking back, thought, oh, you know, what a blow up, what a beat up, what a hype. But it wasn't the actual storytelling. It was the shape of the media response that they noticed. So in a sense, media can kind of draw in this understanding of a pandemic as a kind of crisis and going away without actually having to use, you know, news of the world kind of language. Very different to HIV, where particular individuals, particular types of individuals were kind of demonized and vilified in the media.
I guess what you're saying is not only are the narratives about epidemics different and we maybe can't make assumptions about the particular form that they'll take, but I suppose also within an epidemic there will be multiple stories and multiple narratives. So could you just describe a little bit, what do you think are the kind of particular characteristics of the COVID narrative or narratives?
Without hindsight, it's hard to decode it, complexity, so politicized. So I think there's something polysemic. It's just there are so many voices, there are so many kind of perspectives. You know, it's impossible to characterize it simply, I think, which is maybe why the numbers figure so much. You know, I'm wondering if that's the way to cope with enormity.
So how have you seen data and numbers being part of the COVID narrative?
Well, so I've been interested in the ways in which mathematical modelling has come to play in HIV prevention. It's been a 20-year intensification of the kind of use of modelling to drive HIV prevention and justify it, argue for resources, to use pharmaceutical and mathematical modelling technologies together to produce effects. Our capacity to actually generate that and manage that data has changed. So by 2020, I could just see everything that was being done was all about coming out of the models. So social isolation, social distancing, that concept, that's not a sociological concept. That's modelling jargon. Ferguson did the famous modelling around Spanish influenza and looked at social distancing. So it's an arithmetic label for a certain measure of what was done in the different cities that they used to do the model. But it got turned into a key strategy. And then, of course, data just appeared everywhere. We've never really done that before. So I don't know what it's like in the UK, but we have these people on public broadcasting TV here showing us graphs and talking about flattening the curve and, you know, mapping, comparing the UK and the US and India and China. So actually, so much of the, you know, the kind of media story about the pandemic and modelling science were kind of collapsed together.
And so what are the implications of this dominance of data? How are the numbers being narrated and to what effect?
The basic idea is that, you know, the numbers don't do anything with our story around them. They have to be kind of explained to the publics. And this is not just the content of the story. This is who convenes what publics and that relationship. So I think why I like narratives is it's not just a content thing. It's actually about the ethics of that, of storytelling and listening. And then we can start to think about some stories get told. Some stories are kind of permissible. So the focus on flatten the curve, the kind of comparative statistics about different parts of the world, the kind of use of science to try and assert some kind of control over uncertainty, whose stories are being kind of minimized, you know, and does that mean we're not telling the truth, not telling the story, which is this is a 2-year job. So, you know, flatten the curve, numbers, it's a way of not looking at the future in a funny way, a kind of salve for uncertainty. It's all we have to kind of understand what's going on.
You said here, I wonder who gets left out or left behind in the focus on numbers. Can you speak a little bit about that? Who are you worried about?
Yeah, so it's the we kind of see images on television of people being buried. There's lots of kind of trauma there. You know, how do we memorialize the testimonials? We will need a way of kind of recognizing the loss that's happened.
Next up is my conversation with Joel, which in some ways picks up on this theme about narratives and how data can tell stories. But while Mark was highlighting the need to consider which stories are not getting told, Joel and I discussed some of the ways COVID-19 data has been displayed and visualized to create some quite powerful but also misleading impressions.
So my name is Joel Solonicchio. I'm a physician, but most of my time for the last 20 years has been occupied more with both epidemiology and public health, and also with computer science and the use of technology for public health and healthcare. I don't really have one job. I have lots of different projects. that I've been working on. And I would say they all sort of seem to revolve around data, epidemiology, public health, medicine, technology, those things.
My first question was that, well, I at least think of data visualization as being quite a new kind of techie field, but turning data into images is not a new field. So what would you say is there anything particularly new or different about the kind of visualization that we're seeing with COVID?
Well, I just think it's just gotten easier. I mean, that's the basic point. I sort of associate this with the Industrial Revolution. In the Industrial Revolution, people began to be much more interested in data, and in especially for the purpose of management. And there's a famous sort of aphorism, I'm not sure who came up with it, but saying what matters gets measured, and what gets measured gets managed. So this stuff goes back a long way, but I think the main change has been now it's super easy for us to make visualizations. And unfortunately, I think what that means, it means that it's easy for us to make bad data visualizations. Now, I'm not some kind of data snob. I'm not saying we should restrict people's ability to do this. But I think it's important when you look at things to recognize it doesn't matter if it's the New York Times. Sometimes the New York Times puts out data visualizations that don't make sense. And, you know, to get back to your point about is it new or is it not new, one of the things that I definitely have noticed, mapping in particular is kind of the newest of the new. We sometimes forget that the widespread use of these maps, things like Google Maps, of course, the iPhone, which, you know, suddenly we're all walking around carrying a GPS unit with us. These things are very new. The iPhone only came out in 2007. Very recent. And so the tools basically say, oh, great. Now every piece of data we've got essentially seems to be attached to a set of GPS coordinates so we can map it. And what you wind up with, unfortunately, and I think COVID has been a great example, is you wind up with lots of fantastic new tools to create data maps. And we haven't quite, you know, we're sort of running along behind the kind of epidemiology or the understanding of what's a good data map or what should the map actually depict, or when is a map a useful tool as opposed to the other visualizations. That's kind of running along behind the technology saying, you know, wait, hold on a second. Let's think about this a little bit.
So could you explain some examples that you've seen that have horrified you?
Right. You know, I've given you some links. Obviously, it's a little bit easier to see if you can see these visualizations in front of you. But
yeah, and we'll make them available.
Oh, great. One example, I don't want to in any way deride the institution of Johns Hopkins. Very early on, not the School of Public Health, not the School of Medicine, but one of the computer technology branches of Hopkins had come up with this map that I'm sure many, many of your listeners have seen, which is the black and red, you know, nightmare COVID map. And from the very beginning, you know, February, March, this map was sort of put forward and referenced all over the internet. People saying, oh my gosh, this is the best data visualization about COVID. This is a great way to, quote, follow the pandemic or to follow the course of the pandemic. And as an epidemiologist, when I look at that map, I think to myself, well, how are we supposed to follow the course of a pandemic by looking at a snapshot of a map? I mean, the map doesn't actually have any time component in it at all. And so the concept of following, that is to say, observing over time, can't be done with a snapshot map like the Hopkins map. I don't think this could have happened at the School of Public Health at Hopkins, because someone would have said exactly what I just said. There's no time component. And speculation is simply that the well-meaning people within the computer science department said, wow, we've got this great mapping software. Let's make some maps of the pandemic. And that I think is understandable. The part that's I think a little bit less understandable, or at least less forgivable, I should say, is, for example, the choice of colors, right? The choice of, let's choose like black and blood red as the colors we're going to use, because I can tell you, those are not standard data visualization colors in science. Those are standard visualization colors in video games about zombie apocalypses, right? I mean, you know, tell like, I mean, look at it. Tell me what you see, right? It makes you think it's a video game.
So it's, I've just pulled it up, and there is, it's all, the background is all black, and then there are just these kind of, I guess what used to be bubbles and are now just splodges, mostly covering all of the USA and a lot of Europe. We're drenched in blood.
Right. And well, that's, and of course, you, I think you just pointed out another kind of another issue, a kind of an epidemiological issue, that when you look at that map, the first map that you look at on that page is a map of cumulative cases. So when you look at a cumulative graph or a cumulative map, what you're looking at is a number that can never, by definition, go down. When you look at those, the map that, you know, that first comes up when you go to the COVID map at Johns Hopkins, right? When you look at that, the entirety of North America is blood red, right? All the circles for North America have all overlapped. Even though there are many places in North America, I mean, don't get me wrong, the pandemic, we need to get it under control, and it's not. But there are many places in the United States where there aren't many cases of COVID. We are not, in fact, swimming in red. It dramatically, and that is the word, it dramatically overstates the seriousness of what is going on and the extent of what is going on by using cumulative charts, which cover the entire map with supposed cases, and by using blood red, which of course makes, you know, as I said, it's fantastic for a video game, but you can have, you know, you're not going to be publishing this in the Lancet or the New England Journal of Medicine. Again, I don't know what is motivating the people here or who made the decisions and why, but I will say that, you know, the incentives nowadays for all of this stuff is to get lots of clicks, to get lots of people to come to your website. And, I can't say for sure that that's why they did it, but certainly it fits with the incentives that we have nowadays to essentially drive web traffic. And that shouldn't obviously be the thing that's driving what's going on.
And I guess, to be fair to them, they do have other maps that have like incidence rates now and active cases.
Well, they didn't always have them, and they put those on sort of page 2 and page 3 and page 4. Again, the use of a map is not very helpful in this context at all. But if you're going to use a map, you should be using a map that that gives you some real sense of what's going on, right? A snapshot that makes it look like every area of a particular, geographic unit, let's say the United States, a snapshot that makes it look like every single area is uniformly the same red color, when in fact the COVID outbreak is not uniform in the United States. And in fact, there are many jurisdictions that are hardly affected. And, you know, not every hospital is overrun, et cetera. When you show a data visualization that shows everything as equally affected when they are not equally affected, that is a deceptive visualization. There's just no getting around it.
It's really interesting as well you say that, because one of the things that we, colleagues of mine have been talking a lot about is this kind of like one size fits all approach to epidemic control, and how problematic that has been, and how, you know, there's a lot of argument and debate now about having more localized approaches. It's happening in the UK, it's happening, I think, in many places. So these kind of things promote this idea of a kind of a universal picture.
Right, because if you look at the US or you look at Europe on the Hopkins map, they're all equally 100% affected. And therefore, you could say, well, if there's no difference in how they're affected, why should there be a difference in policy?
So you mentioned drama a lot there, and you said, obviously, you don't know the intentions of the people that did this map. But I guess there are trends that you've, are there trends that you've observed beyond this Hopkins map in the way that data is being visualized about COVID, and maybe this drama or fear factor is being ramped up?
Well, you know, you mentioned the New York Times, and I think the New York Times has used a similar map since the beginning as part of their data visualizations. And the New York Times, I think, has dramatically broadened and made more rich its coverage. But even the New York Times initially was showing the same kind of thing, not the red and black color scheme, but still showing maps and still saying, you know, this is how we can follow the outbreak. And of course, the same flaw applied to that approach. And that flaw was, the maps do not have a time component, and therefore they cannot be used to, quote, follow, end quote, anything.
So
What do you think the implications are for these kind of poor visualizations, and particularly on public understanding?
Well, I think you've hit on one of them, specifically about the map, which is that, you know, when we use data visualizations that seem to show that every place within a geography is equally bad, right, that it emphasizes the uniformity of the outbreak, then it gives us an idea that, well, we should have a uniform approach. Data visualizations that show everything as equally bad do tend to promote the idea that we have to have an equal response everywhere because every place looks the same. That is, I'm sure, has been harmful to the response. Another thing that's happened that I've noted very clearly, and this gets back to the color scheme and all that other stuff, is that I feel like coronavirus has been the first huge public health event, significant public health event that has been essentially adjudicated on social media. Unfortunately, I think that people tend to do things that will get them more followers, right? That will get them more clicks. We are now driven to follow that old newspaper adage of, if it bleeds, it leads. If it's horrible and people died and et cetera, then it's gonna be on the front page. And basically, again, if the graph of cases is going down, but deaths is going up, then what's gonna be on the front page of our Twitter feed is going to be the graph of deaths. We're not giving a balanced view, we're giving the view that will drive people to like our tweets. That is a really corrosive, I think, influence on our understanding of this pandemic. I think in general, the social media has been invaluable in spreading information about this, but as we all know at this point, unfortunately, it spreads both good information and bad.
And that mention of how data and its circulation on social media can be misleading leads us nicely onto my conversation with Tamara and Leonard about the infodemic. While Joel was flagging the incentives for sharing certain data, Tamara and Leonard have been researching how people process the massive amounts of COVID-19 data that we're all inundated with in all its shapes and forms and quality.
Tamara Giles-Vernick. I'm the unit leader of Anthropology and Ecology of Disease Emergence Unit at Institut Pasteur and also coordinator of the SONAR Global Network.
Yes, I'm Leonard Heyerdahl. I work as a postdoc anthropologist at the Institut Pasteur. And recently I used to work on Ebola and cholera outbreaks. And now I'm working, mostly on COVID.
Could one of you please just explain to me what the infodemic is and why people are worried about it?
Yes, so the infodemic has been defined as an overabundance of information, both online and offline. And so this is correct and incorrect information. So this is how the WHO defines infodemic since this year, but the term has been coined almost 20 years ago and was used, but with kind of a low profile. And it was not used only for health-related issues, but false information in general. What is new about the definition of today, there is the notion of the fact that true information is also problematic if it's overabundant. And within the inaccurate information, there's the distinction of misinformation and disinformation. So there's the notion of misinformation, which is not accurate inadvertently, and disinformation, which is manipulation and trying to lead people into getting wrong knowledge, right?
If I could just add to that, I think that that one of the concerns is that when people are confronted with an excessive information or misinformation or disinformation, they're not able to undertake behaviors that would be protective or that would seek access to care and the like. Then I think, you know, there are a number of, I guess, problems with those assumptions, even though, I think at first glance, there's nothing that seems objectionable about this. But I think that there are a couple of assumptions One is that if people are given information, that they will act correctly on it, which is, you know, a first and basic issue. And I think that we've all seen in a number of different locations where people are, you know, rendered vulnerable in one way or another to the shock, the destabilization of pandemics, the economic consequences of those, the consequences of lockdowns and the like, that they can't always act in the way that public health actors would expect them to. So that, I mean, that's one problem, is that information does not necessarily lead to correct action. Another point I think that's important, and that we've really been thinking about quite, you know, in detail, is to think about the relationship between these kind of this online circulation of information, misinformation, and disinformation, and what people think and do offline.
It's difficult to link those two, and there's a lot of different initiatives, but they usually try and track misinformation online or offline, right? So these are different sets of methodologies. And so it's very difficult to know what the impact is going to be if you're just on either sides, right? As anthropologists, we bring a baggage, which is to do semi-structured discussions and mostly listen to the person. And so this is kind of the work that we're trying to do, where the social listening that we're doing is not so much about seeing how many likes X publication got, the metrics and so on, but more characterizing the types of discourses and the semantics.
In terms of the data that we have currently on the infodemic, how would you characterize the kinds of data?
Well, we have mountains of data. Of course, in my taste as an anthropologist, it's too used in terms of quantifying rather than characterizing what people say. And this links to another stance towards knowledge and science, which is that there's this notion that we have the truth and that people need the truth. And so we need to fight false information with the truth. But the problem with this is that it's not so easy. It's not so clear in science. And we've seen it with the mask. We've seen it with the hydroxychloroquine, that there are problems and doubts and so on. And people are now more aware of that than ever. And so it's difficult to restore trust in science if we have this, if we try to tell ourselves that we have the truth absolute. And so we don't recognize that people have legitimate reasons sometimes to have doubts, right?
Just one small point. I think, you know, one of the things that Leonard brought to our work in particular was this, and we're not the only people who were doing it, obviously there are others, but, you know, a lot of this kind of Twitter and online data tends to be quantified, you know, in order for people to conduct their analyses. And what he started all of us doing, we're all participating in it, is a qualitative evaluation of what people say online. And there it becomes, I think, much more ambiguous, that in many cases, unless you're following the whole exchange, unless you're following linkages to other pieces online, unless you're looking at the context in which these utterances appear, it's very difficult, in fact, to determine whether, you know, people think positively or negatively about something. So I think that that's been a really useful way that anthropological tools can be used.
Okay, I'm going to try and summarize.
Within this field of infodemiology, there are some discourses in the field which are linked to the kind of data that it relies on in general, which kind of don't acknowledge some of the kind of uncertainties or the ambiguities, which rely on some binary notions of truth and false and have this information deficit kind of model. But the research that you've been doing has been taking a very different, more anthropological approach. Could you tell me about this, the research that you have been doing then, and what it's finding?
Yes, sure. So what we set to do is to characterize what people say around the virus and around the vaccines and molecules and different measures to fight the pandemic, to characterize it online and to see how these discussions and ideas travel from the online world to the real world in a specific population, which is Red Cross volunteers and workers.
Just for a bit of context, when you talk about the Red Cross workers in France, you're talking about thousands of frontline workers who are performing essential parts of the response in France. What are some of the things that you've been finding?
One of the points that's really come home as we put together the social listening, what people are saying, and then how people in the field in interviews are responding or not, is that the kinds of decisions that people in their offline lives are making they're complex. So it's not just that there's this sort of straight line between, okay, somebody heard this on, or somebody read this on Twitter, and now they're going to go out and do something. We know that there are a whole series of influences about how people see themselves, about how they understand their contributions, about, you know, what family members are saying, about what coworkers are saying, about what the conditions of work are, and the like. So in a sense, there's something that's not so astonishing about what we find in terms of, you know, how anthropologists or other social scientists would see it. But it really has not been sort of teased out in this field of epidemiology. People are starting, I think, Leonard, you correct me if I'm wrong, people are starting to ask the question, but there's a real need to bring the kinds of analytical tools of anthropology and other social sciences to that whole field, and really to think about, okay, so what are people doing with this? A second project that we're involved in is the Recover Project, which is slightly different and asking a slightly different question than what is the relationship between online and offline. And that's with a project called Recover, which is coordinated by the University of Antwerp. That's a project funded by the European Commission. And the initial idea was to do some kind of an online survey of the public about willingness to participate in clinical trials. In a sense, what it turned into, since there's been a lot of really excellent anthropological work that's been done on that question, we decided, given the work that we'd been doing with Twitter, to use that more broadly in Europe and to shape questions that we would ask of a broader public around their trust in governments, in science, in European actors, in the WHO, in, you know, the information that they find in different places, look at their information getting practices. And the other issue that we're really interested in thinking about there is sort of having a dialogue between this very large online survey and what's going on at the same time within social media, to not only look within a representative sample in seven European countries, how widespread is this misinformation? Or, you know, the idea, for instance, that 5G can either cause or worsen COVID-19 or various stories like that. But also to try to the best of our ability to characterize who these people are, where they sit on political spectrums, where they live, what their socioeconomic levels, what their educational levels are. And, you know, I want to be really careful about that because, I mean, obviously nobody wants to stigmatize a particular group, but it might actually help to either develop certain kinds of interventions, even beyond improved communications, to assist people in working through the difficulties of their daily lives so that they can be part of broader communities, gain access to health, not necessarily to have to worry about taking colloidal silver to prevent or control the transmission of COVID-19.
Have you got any examples that you could share with us in a bit more detail?
We did a preliminary analysis, social analysis for Recover to adapt the questionnaire based on the narratives online. And so we saw already then all of the backbone narratives of the pandemic, of the New World Order, and so on, much before there was actually the documentary pandemic. And so it just confirmed again that the epidemics are just another scene of political confrontation, right? That so for many people, COVID or the vaccines are just another way to pass their ideas. And it's not so much about this specific vaccine or the specific virus. And so we saw a lot of zombie rumors. So zombie rumors are Bill Gates is preparing a vaccine to sterilize XYZ group. So this rumor was already present for Zika. It was already present for Ebola. It was, and so it's coming back with every major zoonotic outbreak. So we described it a bit in our reports and so on. And the notion that there were some gradients of distrust, right? The lighter version of distrust are those that all these ideas around the fact that science is corrupted by big pharma, and so there's economic profiteering. And then you have like deeper layers of distrust in which people think that there's a sort of a cabal to end at least sections of humanities, right, through the pandemic. But then there are some less or lower profile questions. And so, for instance, regarding viral incertitudes, there was this discussion about Kawasaki cases, you know, early during the epidemic, that perhaps children affected by COVID, there may be a possibility that it is triggering Kawasaki cases at an alarming rate among children. So this news, kind of half knowledge because it wasn't sure, sort of started popping out during the first lockdown in France and reemerged like a week before schools were supposed to reopen. And so we, for instance, I talked to one worker. She's a mom. She was spending her time at home. She wasn't able to go on the field, which was problematic for her because she wanted to participate. She wanted to help the people that she knew needed her help, but she had to take care of her kids. And she was looking forward to the moment where she could put the kids back at school so they could continue their schooling and she could go back to work and so on. And she had adopted a general position of shutting down media because she was too bothered by it and it was too heavy for her. But she was still continuing to check her social media and so on. And so one day, a week before reopening the schools, she got a link to a newspaper article saying Kawasaki cases, the children are no longer safe and so on, from one of the major newspaper of France. And it's someone in her family sent it to her, mentioning her on Facebook, right? And so even though she tried to avoid it, the story still came to her. And then she was like asking herself, well, maybe I'm not going to put back my kids back at school. I have to continue. And it put her, it really affected her like deeply. And in the end, she decided not to open Facebook anymore. And she didn't receive any news from Kawasaki. And she supposed that it was fine in the end, but didn't want to check. And her kids went back to school and she went back on the field. But for a few weeks, she kind of felt bad also about it. But she decided to just go on and try to ignore, even though like the infodemic still kind of got her, right? So that's the lower kind of stories. But
just to bounce off of a couple of things that Leonard also said, I mean, that was actually, I think, in our first round of interviews and you know, the other types of research that we've been doing, that was actually one of the sort of surprising things, that people basically have ways of protecting themselves. And it's, you know, maybe not everybody, but at a certain point, I think there are a number of interviews where people just said, look, you know, at a certain point, I just had to turn off, shut off my social media feed. I shut off the TV and, you know, just stopped listening. Another interesting story, which actually has to do with our institution, that is Institut Pasteur, is that early on in the pandemic, maybe March or April of 2020, there was a widely circulated video, I think on Facebook, in which a person was basically accusing the Institut Pasteur of having patented the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and actually flashed up on the screen a patent from I think something like 2003 or 2004, and accusing the Institut Pasteur of having invented or created the virus with the eye to recuperating funding through a vaccine. Now, we know that this isn't correct. This had to do with the initial SARS outbreak. It didn't have anything to do with current activities at the Institut Pasteur. But I think what's interesting from a kind of anthropological and historical perspective is who actually made the video. And it turns out this was someone who was active within the Gilets Jaunes. In English, they're called the yellow vests. And these, you know, tended to be working class and retired people who had really been pushed to sort of the brink of existence, were really, really struggling. And since 2018, have been protesting a number of the measures that have been undertaken by the Macron government. And, you know, I think that one of the things that this at least illustrated to me is that people are, in effect, casting their nets very widely. And the fact that Institut Pasteur is a private biomedical and public health research organization that receives some but relatively little funding from the state, but you know that there are all kinds of linkages to scientists, for instance, from the institutions, sit on the scientific council for the government. You know, there's a whole sort of both a lexical field as well as perceived historical relations between various entities that have the Pasteur name in them and the French government. And, you know, I think that it's really important to dig into that, to understand those relationships better and why it is that people are making the accusations that they do. And I think that we could move well beyond the point of just saying that's not true, and trying to respond in a sense to the anxieties, perceptions of corruption, you know, and critiques of neoliberal policies and the like.
Both of those are fascinating stories.
So first of all, you're saying that people's responses and reactions are not what we would necessarily assume, and that they're not just kind of ingesting or drinking up this information. And second, that they have coping and protective strategies. And then, Leonard, you had this beautiful phrase that pandemics were just another scene of political confrontation. So the idea that whether it's Institut Pasteur or Bill Gates, the anxieties and the tensions and their social and political roots go back much further. So taking all of that into account, how should we be dealing with the infodemic? What are some of the alternative ways of addressing it?
I think one of the points that we really need to keep in mind is, does it make a difference? Does it make a difference that people believe that 5G causes COVID? Does it prevent them from doing what they need to do to gain access to care or to socially distance or something else, or even to get a vaccination? I think one of the points that you know, we find as as people who do social sciences field work, for instance, in, you know, in Europe and in other parts of the world, and, you know, in West Africa or Central Africa, is that sometimes you don't have to argue with people about the etiology of an illness. You can just say, okay, you know, if this happens, it's a really great idea to go to your local health center. It's not that you have to sit around and argue with people about what causes what. If you can give them the resources as well to engage with certain kinds of public health measures that would allow them and their families to remain among the living.
Yeah, it's echoing as well so much from the Ebola epidemic that, you know, the difference between what people believe and what people do, all the kind of surveys that talk about people's kind of beliefs and stuff and have these really worrying things about no one believes that Ebola is real, or everyone think people are hesitant about the vaccine. What people will actually do in their lives is often quite different to that. So do we not need to worry about the infodemic?
No, I think that we also need to put a caveat, because there have been cases, very sad cases of translation. So one of the biggest examples for this pandemic was what happened in Iran, where there was these fake remedies based on methanol, and hundreds of people like ingested it and died. And so this is a clear example of how infodemics can kill. But the work that has to be done, I guess, is to see to what extent they translate it and under which circumstances, and mostly what kind of barriers to infodemics do exist in our social networks in the way that we negotiate with conflicting information, right? Because it's not black or white.
Well, I would not want to suggest, you know, that it doesn't matter. It does matter. It does matter. But, you know, when you've got 10,000 fires to put out, you've basically got to pick which ones are actually really going to make a difference. And I think it's maybe making some judicious choices about which ones absolutely must be addressed and which ones people could survive, you know, and go along in their daily lives and society can continue to function. It would be better for them not to, but maybe it doesn't make any difference.
And with that thought-provoking question, we've come to the end of this episode. I'd like to say a big thank you to all our contributors, Mark, Joel, Tamara, and Leonard. And I hope we are leaving you with some new insights about how we can make sense of and deal with the infodemic, how we can be wise to the ways that data is used to shape narratives or is distorted by visualizations, and to be alert to what is obscured by these uses of data. Thanks for listening. Please check out www.sonar-global.eu for more about the network and for future podcasts.